But today I'd like to turn to and start by turning to the book of Zephaniah. Zephaniah, it's after Habakkuk and it's before Haggai. And if that doesn't help, you go to the end of the Old Testament and go back four books. You go to Malachi and then start in Malachi, Zechariah, and then Haggai, and then Zephaniah. And while you're turning there, I'd like to read from an article that you can find on the Life, Hope, and Truth site. This comes from an introduction to the book of Zephaniah, written by Mr. Andre Van Belkum. He pastors the church there in New Zealand and the Pacific. We met him in 2017. We went to New Zealand. Very fine man. He is retiring, and I saw Mr. John Pinelli gave the sermon there yesterday. So I'm not sure if he's taken over already or not, but this article by Mr. Van Belkum, he writes, Zephaniah's prophetic revelations and stern warnings occurred during Josiah's reign, Zephaniah 1 and verse 1. And this would place the writings between 640 and 609 BC. Josiah led Judah to religious and social reform, but Zephaniah declared that these spiritual changes would not last. The people of Judah would return to their wickedness and their rebellion against God. The northern kingdom of Israel was already in captivity, and Babylon was gaining in power and prestige. God had determined that the Babylonians would be his instrument to punish the nation of Judah. Zephaniah and his contemporaries, Jeremiah and Habakkuk, were some of the prophets that God used to pronounce this warning message. Under the section of the article, main theme, the theme of the book is the day of the Lord. Despite the fact that Zephaniah warns Judah of impending doom, the prophecy is dual and major fulfillment of this prophecy is yet future. He goes on, this book points forward to the dramatic and earth-shaking events that will unfold before the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. Hopefully you've made it to Zephaniah. Let's start in Zephaniah chapter 1 in verse 14, where it writes, the great day of the Lord is near. It is near and hastens quickly. The noise of the day of the Lord is bitter. There the mighty men shall cry out. A day is a day of wrath, a day of trouble and distress, a day of devastation and desolation, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet and alarm against the fortified cities and against the high towers. I will bring distress upon men, and they shall walk like blind men because they have sinned against the Lord. The blood shall be poured out like dust, and their flesh like refuse. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath, and the whole land shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy, for he will make speedy riddance of all those who dwell in the land. Continuing on with the article, when these major prophecies come to pass, it will be better to be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger than to be in the midst of what occurs when God intervenes and brings righteous judgment on mankind. Zephaniah 2 and verse 3, seek the Lord, all you meek of the earth, who has upheld his justice. Seek righteousness, seek humility. It may be well that you will be hidden from the day of the Lord's anger. So it may be that you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. Article continues, God's indignation will be poured out on all the nations, and none will escape God's anger and be felt worldwide. So the prophet suggests that if some will seek the Lord and uphold his justice, if some seek righteousness and humility, then they may be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. Continuing with the introduction to the preface of this book of Zephaniah by Mr. Van Belkum, there's very good reason that God will punish the nations. Lawlessness, iniquity, and ungodly human conduct will abound. Those who seek and trust God will become part of the remnant who will be examples of righteous conduct to the nations. And in Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 12, we find this, I will leave you in your midst a meek and humble people, and they shall trust in the name of the Lord. The remnant of Israel shall do no unrighteousness and speak no lies, and shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth, and they shall feed their flocks and lie down, and none of them shall be afraid. We just sang the song, "Don't Be Afraid, My People." Don't be afraid, my people. But the article continues, "For those who are willing to seek and to submit to God, God promises them protection during this period of unprecedented destruction." Well, this promise of protection is the subject that I'd like to address in the message today. I'd like to examine the scriptures that surround the need for protection, along with some possible reasons why some will be protected, and the Bible reveals that some will not be. The title of today's message is End Time Considerations. End Time Considerations. It would have been so easy to name it Place of Safety, but because that phrase is directly not found in the Bible, I will call the message End Time Considerations. You know, this time of great tribulation was also prophesied by the prophet Daniel. Let's go back a few pages to the book of Daniel, and we'll pick it up in chapter 12 of Daniel. Daniel chapter 12. And I know after trumpets, brethren, and after the message of atonement, talking about recapturing the first love, I hope that you don't think I'm negative Debbie up here, but this is actually meant to be a message of hope, because God promises protection for his people in the months and the years ahead. But Daniel 12 and verse 1, again, I'm just trying to set the stage here. "At the time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of the people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even at that time. And at your time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book of life." There are promises of protection. There's promises of hope that God offers to his people. Again, we will come back to the Old Testament to examine a number of prophecies in time that relate to the second coming and this protection. But let's go over to Matthew chapter 24. A number of things were said leading up to Matthew chapter 24. And his disciples in verse 3 has asked the question that in that early first century, and it has been the questions that have been asked down throughout history. "As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him," again, Matthew 24 and verse 3, "privately saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what would be the sign of your coming and the end of your age, of the age?'" Again, this question has been asked down through history. What will be the sign of your coming? What's going to be the sign of the end of the age? So Jesus discusses here a few of the seals that we also talked about on trumpets. He discusses false religion, wars and rumors of wars. Nation will rise up against nation. He mentions famines and pestilences and earthquakes in verse 7 of Matthew 24. He talks about persecution in verse 9 and 10. "They shall be delivered you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake, and many will be offended and betray one another and will hate one another." In verse 12, "And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." Lawlessness will be widespread on this earth, and the love of many will grow or wax cold. He mentions the abomination of desolation. There's an entire article on the abomination of desolation on the Life, Hope, and Truth site. You just go there and search for it, you'll find it. But briefly, the first occurrence of this was in 168 to 167 BC. This occurred after Alexander the Great had died at an early age. His four generals took over. And one of those, Seleucus the First, actually started this Seleucid empire. And the eighth king, King Antiochus the Fourth, better known as Antiochus Epiphanes, appointed a priest. The priest rebelled, and the empire came down, killing thousands of Jews and selling others into slavery. They set up this Zeus Olympus upon the altar of the sacrifice. At the time, they offered sacrifices on the 25th of each month, starting with the 25th of December. And since the 25th of the month was celebrated as the birthday of Epiphanes, these sacrifices were made directly to him. Literature called this altar of Zeus the abomination that makes desolate. And they referenced Daniel 11, verse 31 and 12:11, according to the Bo Reiki, the New Testament era, pages 55 and 56. He also defiled the temple at that time by having swine sacrificed on it. And then a second fulfillment of the abomination of desolation occurred in AD 70 under Roman armies, under Titus, when they sacked the city of Jerusalem. Luke 21 and verse 20 identifies Jerusalem being surrounded by armies before the desolation in AD 70. And in the process, Titus's forces destroyed the temple, building an altar, and it has not been rebuilt even to this day. It's interesting that the historian Eusebius recorded in his third book, chapter 5, the members of the church in Jerusalem were instructed by a prophecy revealed to the leaders to abandon the city before the war and to take up residence in one of the cities of Perea, which was named Pella. Pella is believed to be in Jordan. It's northeast of Jerusalem and south east of the Dead Sea. It's kind of between the Dead Sea, southeast of the Sea of Galilee, I should say. It's almost halfway in between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea or the Salt Sea, actually about 40% down. But they've fled to Pella. And then Josephus, I did bring this book, and you're welcome to look at this. In his book, The War of the Jews, in book 6, chapter 5, and section 3, find an interesting passage, or section in that book, I should say. Moreover, at that feast that we call Pentecost, all the priests were going to the inner court of the temple, as their custom was, to perform their sacred administration. They said that in the first place they felt a quaking. It was like an earthquake. And then they heard the sound of a great multitude, the people that were in the temple there, saying, "Let us remove hence." This was likely on Pentecost of 69 AD, because by the time that 70 AD rolled around in Pentecost, the city was pretty much destroyed. So supposedly there weren't that many people in there, and yet they felt this quaking. And then they heard this multitude saying, "Let us remove hence." In other words, let us get out of here. And God's true church fled to Pella at that point. This event also appears to be a forerunner of a similar event that will happen before the return of Jesus Christ. Again, there's much more information that you can find. Just search for the abomination of desolation on the Life, Hope, and Truth site. But let's drop down to verse 21 here, where Christ is speaking, and he says, "For them will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor ever shall be. And unless those days should be shortened, no flesh would be saved or save alive. Before the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." Like the prophet Daniel or the prophet Zephaniah, Jesus here personally reveals a time of trouble that was coming upon the whole earth. And unless those days are shortened, unless God steps in to intervene to save humanity from themselves, no flesh would be saved alive. Now let's go through the book of Revelation. It's easy to sometimes overlook the fact that the writers of the Old Testament and the New Testament had no knowledge of Revelation whatsoever. All the writers, except for John, had died. They weren't even aware that Revelation existed, let alone know what was in the book of Revelation. It was a lot like the book of Daniel. "Go your way, Daniel. These words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end." But the first chapter of Revelation shows that it is the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his servants things that must shortly take place, and he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, to all the things that he saw. So we learned that the meaning of the book of Revelation, from those that have gone before us. I don't know how many have gone through the church history classes or not, but it was revealed last century. And we learned it from them, all the ministers that have learned it from Mr. Armstrong and others. It was explained in the church history there. But our understanding is only about 100 years old or so. But people generally read this prophecy in order to understand what is coming, what's coming down the pike. But notice what Christ reveals to the Apostle John, who records this in verse 3. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is at near. Not only are we to read and to hear the words of this prophecy, but we are to keep the things that we find in this book. Do we read the book of Revelation in order to keep the things that are written in it? What does it mean to keep? The Greek word for keep is tereo. It's like the word stereo without the S, tereo. The word keep means to guard from loss or injury, to be able to keep an eye on something. It means to hold fast, to observe, to preserve, or even reserve. It means to watch. So not only are we to hear and read and hear the words of this prophecy, we are to guard these words from loss or injury. We are to hold fast to what is read or heard. We are to watch, we are to observe, we are to preserve what is written in the pages of the book of Revelation. And most importantly, we are supposed to remember what is written here as time goes on. It's good to remember the purpose of the book of Revelation. In chapter 1 and verse 19, write the things which you have seen, the things which are, and the things that will take place after this. In another Life, Hope, and Truth article of the Seven Churches written by Mr. David Trebig, he points out this book is both historical and prophetic. He also mentions in the same article, students of the Bible have noted that the messages to the seven churches imply a progressive history of things which will take place after this. And he quotes the same verse, Revelation 1 and verse 19. Some have described this as a chronological development of the church or church eras. He himself calls it church eras. Some don't believe that today, but apparently there's a lot of scriptural support and historical support for that. But in other words, the church started off, and when it first was there, that's part of the Ephesus era. And as you get to the end of it, the Laodicean and Philadelphian and Laodicean in that order would be at the end. But in Revelation 3, regardless of whether it's an era or the church in that male root that you read in Revelation 1 and verse 11, Christ says this to them. He, again, is writing to the churches of that time and possibly, well, to us. We'll read that and confirm that in a moment. Revelation 3 and verse 7, to the angel of the church of Philadelphia say, he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, who shuts and no one opens, I see your works, I know your works, see I've set before you an open door, no man can shut it. You have a little strength, you've kept my word and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie, indeed, I will make them come down and worship before your feet to know that I have loved you. Because you've kept my command to persevere, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that shall come upon the whole earth to test those who dwell on the earth. The church in Philadelphia, because of their works, because of the fact that it kept God's word, because they did not deny God's name, because they kept God's commandments and perseveres, Jesus states in verse 10 that he will keep them from the hour of trial that shall come upon the whole earth to test those on the earth. Although this was written first to the church, the Philadelphia church at Philadelphia, on that mail route during the first century, history does not record a worldwide hour of trial that occurred upon the whole earth at that time. They didn't have that. It had to apply to churches down the road. Again, the physical church of Philadelphia did not suffer worldwide tribulation back then. So it means that the messages that were given to the seven churches were not meant solely for them. It's important to note, to read, to hear. It's important to keep what is read, especially at the end of each church message. It's written over and over, he that has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, plural. So the messages to the seven churches, the characteristics or the qualities contained within these messages can be applied to any time period down through history. Now let's go to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12, the dragon is mentioned in verse 3, and his influence drew a third of the angels of heaven in verse 4. Then in verse 5, the woman, that is God's chosen nation of Israel, is described as giving birth to a male child who was to rule all nations with a rule of iron. Reading from another one of Mr. Trabig's articles, who are the woman, child, and the dragon in Revelation 12, he writes, the verse continues, and child was caught up to God and his throne. The language here makes it clear that Jesus is the child in Revelation 12. Jesus is the one prophesied to strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. Revelation 19 and verse 15, he is also the one after the resurrection who was taken up in a cloud to heaven. And in verse 6, continuing from the article, in verse 6, the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Sometimes people get this confused with the 1,260 days that is mentioned in verse 14. It's a different point. As he writes, the verse indicates the true church was protected by God for 1,260 years, and he references Numbers 14 and verse 34. And Ezekiel 4 and verse 6, showing that a day can represent a year in prophecy. During that time, which has continued through the Middle Ages, the church was protected from its enemies. Again, Mr. Trabig is writing this for 1,260 years, including the Roman Empire and Christianity. So we see here that this occurred before Satan had war breaking out and having great wrath in verse 12. Then you come to another 1260-day period. We'll talk about that momentarily. There's a bit of history that might be helpful to explain why the church had to flee into the wilderness for 1260 years. Diocletian, a Roman emperor from 284 to 305, and Galerius from 305 to 307 were very difficult to deal with. In AD 306, they actually had a general sacrifice made to the pagan gods. Christian recusants were mutilated, and they were sent to the mines and the quarries. The years from AD 305 to 313 may refer to the 10 years that the Church of Ephesus in Revelation 2 and verse 10 had to go through. And then following these two Roman emperors was Constantine. He was the one that had this vision of a cross. And on one side of the cross, it was written in Latin, supposedly, by this cross you shall conquer. And he thought this vision was meant for him to take this symbol and to go forth and to conquer. So in AD 321, Constantine issued a civil decree making Sunday a day of rest for everyone except for farmers. Then in AD 325, Pope Sylvester I named Sunday the Lord's Day. Also in AD 325, because of the various schisms and the bickering that was going on amongst the churches that had developed, Constantine ordered the Council of Nicaea. He had all the bishops of the so-called church at that time gathered together, and they had to decide on one religion that was to go forward so that everybody could pursue the same thing. And what came out of this became the state religion of that time. Amongst other things, they formalized an Easter observance, and they made Passover, it was forbidden to be kept. So consequently, the church, who honored the Sabbath and Passover, had to go underground. They had to go into the wilderness. And that is what verse 6 is speaking of. And you add 1260 to 325, and you fast forward to 1585. What happened in 1585? You find Henry VIII, and he was known as the father of the English Reformation that separated England from the Roman Catholic Church. He also changed the relationship between the church and the state, giving the crown more power and the clergy less. And of course, you had Martin Luther and his 95 Theses in 317, early part of the 4th century. And that may have played into Henry VIII taking a stance. But at the end of the 1260 years, as verse 6 points out, the church began to be able to move back into the more populated areas. Again, this was a different time period than what we're about to read in Revelation 12 and verse 14. Consider this for a moment. When the tribulation starts, what are the logistics? Can we barricade ourselves behind locked doors with enough food and water to wait it out? You know, there was a school of thought at one time that God could protect us wherever we were. But is that biblical? Is that what the Bible says? With multiple nuclear attacks and atrocities that are associated with that, with invading armies coming and taking people captivity, even if God could provide some type of bubble around us, what kind of life would that be? Is it possible to camp out in our living rooms for 3.5 years? Never going out, always having enough food and water, somehow keeping people from coming in and taking it, enduring the heat that is going to be escalated during that time due to nuclear warfare. And even if you could survive that, what would that do to a person poking out, maybe looking out a window, maybe it's your own family, shriveling up? And I don't want to get too graphic here, but anyhow. Over the years, others have not believed God. They've actually tried to build their own bomb shelters. And there's humorous stories about trailers getting so much canned goods in it that they collapse because they're overpacked. They didn't believe that God was going to protect them. They also tried to take matters into their own hands. But what does the Bible teach? In verse 12, "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them, woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows he has a short time. And when the dragon saw it had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child." Christ was very clear here. He stated, if they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. Eventually, Satan's wrath here, as described in verse 12, is going to be very great. And when you couple the great wrath of the devil with the great tribulation, God is going to have to help out the woman. That is, God is going to have to help out the church. In verse 14, it records this. Again, we are to hear, we are to keep these things that are written in this book. "But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and a times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. And we understand that a time is 1 year in prophecy, times is 2 years, and half a time, it's a 3.5 year period, 1260 days, if you will. You know, in the wilderness, you have to learn to rely upon God very, very much. God wants to cement into us total reliance upon him. And a wilderness very much would accomplish that. The church will flee into what the Bible calls her place. It doesn't say her places. It is singular. But John recorded it here as revealed by the Revelator as her place. A place that was prepared for by God to be nourished and therefore to be protected. You know, there's only two other places in the Bible that mention the woman was given two wings of a great eagle. There's a third passage in Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 31 that discusses those who wait unto the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. But this is not talking about a displacement from one place to another. Isaiah 40 is really implying one state to another state. You go from needing strength, looking to God, and then coming to have strength. When we wait on God, he shall renew our strength. It's a big difference than what is described here in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 14. So the other two places, let's do look at that. It describes the people of one nation as they literally move. Let's look at Exodus chapter 19. Again, we're trying to get an understanding. What does Revelation 12 and verse 14 mean? Exodus chapter 19 in verse 1. The third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai, for they had departed from Rephidim and come to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain. Rephidim was in Egypt, and he went to the wilderness in Sinai. And notice what the Lord said to Moses in verse 3. Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself." Yes, they walked. There were no flights during that time. But he says he bore them on eagle wings and brought them to himself. Again, they were in one nation, and God brought them to another nation. He declares, "By eagle wings, I brought you to myself." And then going forward to Deuteronomy chapter 32, we see a second instance of this. And notice what happened. Again, it was displacement of the people being referenced. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 10, he found him in a desert land, and in a wasteland, a howling wilderness. We were talking before services, we have coyotes that live in behind our house, and sometimes they get yapping, yipping, and it's just so eerie, and then the coyotes across the street at the neighbor's house, they start in, you have stereo yipping and howling. It is very eerie to listen to that late at night. I was telling some, as we were gathered there, I'm kind of afraid to go out to my deer stand before it gets light sometimes, thinking about all those coyotes. But in verse 10, he found them in a desert land, in a wasteland, a howling wilderness. He encircled them, he instructed them, he kept them as the apple of his eye. We know that God just didn't find them in the wilderness. He performed miracles to bring them out of Egypt. He opened up the Red Sea so they could cross it. But he's making a point that in the desert land, in the wasteland, in the howling wilderness, he worked with them. He led them around, he instructed them, he kept them as the apple of his eye. As an eagle stirs up her nest, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings. God was working with them, as with an eagle when she stirs up the nest. If a predator or some kind of danger comes upon an eagle's nest, the parent eagle will act. The little eaglets will get on her wings. They dig in deep, and the mama eagle will fly them to a place of safety. Those little eaglets, they dig so deep in that the flapping of the wings, they are not displaced. But the mama eagle will take them to a different location, a safe location. Likewise, with the nation of Israel, God carried them on his wings, taking them up, as verse 11 says. In verse 12, so the Lord alone led him. There was no foreign God with him. So we find that there are two other references that refer to God's nation or God's people being relocated into a different land. And I've seen people point to these verses and say, well, they walked, they didn't fly, so it doesn't mean that you're going to fly. They focus on the flying. They say that it's only symbolic of what Revelation 12 is. But what really should be said is that being mounted on eagle's wings is symbolic of a nation or a people going to a different place. It doesn't mention flying here in Deuteronomy 32 or Exodus 19. It simply states, I bore you on eagle's wings and I brought you to myself, or carrying them on eagle's wings, as stated in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Only in verse 14 of Revelation 12 does it mention the term really flying. Let's turn back there and let's examine that term for a moment. The word for fly here, well, let me just read the verse again. Woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place. The word fly comes from the Greek word petaohi or ami, ahi. It's a P-E-T-O-M-A-I, the Greek word. And it literally means to fly, to go up into the air. It's a different word than the word fuge that was used as flight back in the books, the gospel accounts, where it's talking about fleeing to the mountains. That's the word fuge. It means to flee or escape. The word here for fly literally means to fly. Literally means to fly. But the church, that is God's people, are going to be given two wings of the great eagle to fly, literally meaning to fly, to go up in the air to a wilderness that we would be nourished for 3.5 years. Being nourished, being in a place apart from the presence of the serpent, sounds like a place of protection to me. It specifically states that the earth somehow helped the woman. It swallowed up the armies with the dragon and the beast powers cast at them. Moses was inspired to lead the Israelites into the wilderness. There's a city in the wilderness of Sinai today called Wadi Musa. It's like Waldo, except Wadi, called Wadi Musa. Wadi means valley, and Musa means Moses. It's the valley of Moses. And tradition has it that Moses was there, and I'll probably get into more of that next time. It's very interesting to understand where that is today. Along with Ain Musa, A-I-N, Musa. Ain Musa is an archaeological site in the Middle East. It means the spring of Moses or the well of Moses. But let's continue in the flow of the story here. Since a woman was taken to the wilderness to be nourished for 3.5 years, the devil gets riled. We understand that Satan will be working through a government at the end time, known as the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, and the floods are representative of armies. In a Life, Hope, and Truth article, again by Mr. Trebek, who are the woman, child, and dragon in Revelation 12, he writes, "And even though Satan will spew water out of his mouth like a flood to try to get to the woman, he will not be successful. In a passage, the concept of a flood likely represents armies," and he quotes or references Isaiah 59, verse 59, and Jeremiah 46, verses 7 and 8. And then in verse 15, "So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood." Perhaps even try to prevent the church from fleeing in the first place. Verse 16, "But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened up its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth." Perhaps this was an earthquake, we don't know. And notice verse 17, "The dragon was enraged with the woman. He went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and who have the testimony of Jesus Christ." He goes back to where he finds the remnant of the church, and he starts to make war with the remnant of the church, those that didn't go to this place, this wilderness, those who are left behind for this reason or that, or who chose to stay behind. He makes war with them. Or perhaps they didn't keep the word patiently, as we read back in Revelation 3 and verses 8 to 10. Perhaps these are the ones that are addressed to the church at Laodicea. We're not sure. It doesn't distinctly identify. But regardless why they are not in the group mentioned in verse 14, it declares that in verse 17, Satan will go to make war with the remnant. Those who keep the commandments and the testimony of Jesus Christ, make no mistake, these are God's people. But for some reason, whatever reason, they are not in the wilderness being nourished and undoubtedly protected. You know, it's one thing, as you look to the future, we can likely anticipate. That is, the proposal of the fleeing of the church will likely be publicized. With instant communication, as we talked about or heard about communication, a sermon that today, appreciate that very much. Will there be additional persecution or mockery? Will the church in the end time be compared to the religious zealots that have occurred over the years, to the Seventh-day Adventist group in Waco, Texas, it was Waco at the time, but Waco, Texas, the Branch Davidians, or the Doomsday Heaven's Gate cult in 1997, who thought that there was an alien ship behind the Hale-Bopp comet, and they committed suicide in order to get on that ship? Will the church contemplating fleeing to a wilderness area be compared to the Jim Jones cult in the late 70s? Will people wonder, are we or the church at that time, whenever it occurs, going to drink the Kool-Aid? But the armies of verse 15 again may even suggest that the government may try to prevent the beast power to keep the church from fleeing in the first place. In all likelihood, there will probably be pressure to stay, perhaps from the government or even from the family. There are many things to consider when one has to make a decision. You know, they're tugging at our shirt tails, your boss or your family. Don't go, wait it out. Don't sell all your car and your possessions. There has to be witnesses back here. There's a number of arguments that could be made to why some will not flee into this wilderness protection. You know, what has been referenced to as the gospel accounts has a couple of passages, and both of them involve prayer I'd like to keep in mind today. Revelation 24 and verse 20. Says, and pray that your flight not be on winter or on the Sabbath. Now, the word for flight here is once again fuge, meaning fleeing or an escape. When the church fled to Pella, you know, they did not literally fly, but they did flee, they did escape. This was a dual prophecy. It's likely written in a way so that both that are involved with the occurrence could understand. And then the other considerations can be found. So we're to pray that our flight not be on the Sabbath day. And then Luke chapter 21, another prayer that we are to pray. Luke 21 and verse 36, Christ writes, watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all the things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. What does it mean to be counted worthy? How are we counted worthy or accounted worthy? Well, first of all, we're obeying God. We are to remember the blessings upon those who read and hear the prophecies and to those who keep those things that are written in it. You know, if God somehow tells us that we are to flee, then we have a choice. We have a choice to make. I don't think we would be in the worthy category if we refuse to go. If the leadership comes down or if we all have the same dream, I don't know how God is going to do it. The Bible doesn't talk about it. But we'll have a choice. If that time comes in our timeline, we don't know when it's coming. No man knows, only the Father in heaven. Maybe Christ knows about it now, but at the time that Christ spoke for it, he said only the Father knows the time, the day or the hour. But 2 Thessalonians 1 and verse 11, Paul declares to the church at Thessalonica, wherefore also we pray always for you that our God count you worthy of his calling and fulfill all the good pleasure of his goodness and the work of faith with power. It encompasses a number of elements and a lot of territory. We are to keep our calling in mind. We are to be appreciative of it. We are to fulfill all the good pleasure of God's goodness. God has much goodness that as we examine his word. We are to be counted worthy. We are to have the work of the faith with power. We are to be zealous and maintain or recapture that first love, as we talked about last time. The word worthy is translated from a Greek word. It's axioo, axioo. I didn't make a mistake that time, like I usually do, but it's axioo, which means to deem entitled or fit. We must be fit. It means desire or to think good, to count or to think worthy or worthily. Again, watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all the things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. What percentage will encompass those who actually flee to the wilderness? Is it 50%? 80%? 10%? We really don't know. We really don't know. The Bible does not say. Some will be accounted worthy, and apparently some will not. We are to watch and pray always. We are to watch world events. We are to watch the activities of the church. We are to keep abreast of what's going on in the work of God. We are to stay focused, to stay diligent. We are to stay ready. How many sermons have we heard? We heard some before the feast about getting ready for the church, and we heard some since we've returned home. You're even hearing one today. Matthew 24, in verse 44, therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour that you do not expect. Who then is faithful and a wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his house to give them food in due season. We are to be ready. We are to be ready. In verse 46, blessed is a servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Let's examine a couple of different but similar instances. There's a reason I feel that Jesus grouped these two events together, and both of them can be found over in the book of Luke, verse 17. Luke, verse 17, beginning in verse 26. And it was as in the day of Noah, also it will be in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage to the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. So here we have the first example in which a place of safety, if you will, was provided before the flood, and I want to emphasize before the flood came. Moses had preached for 120 years, but the people continued in their lifestyle. They ate, they drank, they were given in marriage. Pretty much life went on the same for them. But instead of taking to heart what Noah was preaching, they pretty much disregarded it or ignored it or made fun of it. And finally, one day, the door of the ark shut. And at that point, no one else could enter the ark. So Noah and his family's place of safety was in an ark. God provided him safety in the confines of that ark. And a second example can be found in the next few verses. And the reason I say that both are connected is because notice how this starts off in verse 28. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, likewise, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sowed, they planted, they built. And on that day, Lot went out of Sodom. It rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. In a similar fashion, warnings were sent out to Lot's family before it was burned, before destruction came to them. And we see that Lot's wife really didn't want to leave her home. Not only did she turn back, but she purposed in her heart to go back. They were initially to flee to the mountains. The mountains were originally intended to protect them. And in verse 30, we're reminded that these two examples, so will be in a day when the Son of Man comes. Even so, it will be in that day when the Son of Man is revealed. So before Christ returns, just as before the flood, just as before Sodom was destroyed, a warning will go out and a choice will have to be made. Do we do this? Or do we do that? But verse 32 is a pretty stark reminder when it comes down to making our choice. Remember Lot's wife. Remember Lot's wife. Remember what happened to her. Let's actually revisit this account because there's an important point I want to bring out. In Genesis chapter 19, let's look at this account. I want to drive a point home, if you would. Genesis chapter 19 and verse 12. I'm in Deuteronomy. Let me go to Exodus, or Genesis, rather. Genesis chapter 19, in verse 12. Then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here, son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, whomever you have in the city? Take them out of this place. Angel said, get them out of here. They didn't say, hunker down, be protected in your own homes. They said, get out of this place, for we will destroy it. The outcry against them is so great before the face of the Lord that the Lord has sent us here to destroy it, they said. And Lot went out, in verse 13, and Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-laws who had just married his daughters. They said, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But to the sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. The sons-in-laws didn't believe. In all likelihood, word spread and the neighborhood got wind of this. Perhaps they were ribbing Lot, making fun of him. You're going where? Up to the mountains, to some sort of wilderness? Stop and think about what you're doing. This is your home. We are your family. And apparently, even Lot began to linger. Verse 15. And when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of your city. And while he lingered, again, this even affected Lot, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of the two daughters, and Lord being merciful to him, they brought him outside, and they set him outside the city. And verse 17, and it came to pass when they brought him outside, he said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you or stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. Lot was seemingly dragging his feet here. Notice verse 18, and Lot said, Then Lot said to them, please know, my lords, indeed now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have increased your mercy, which you have shown me by saving my life, but I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me, and I die. It's interesting what Lot said. He was afraid to escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake him, and he dies. When it's time to flee, this account is one of two mentioned. How many will refuse to flee? How many will refuse to go to the wilderness, this wilderness that God has prepared because they are afraid that some evil might arise? God wanted to leave Sodom, them to leave Sodom and flee to the mountains, but they ended up going to Zoar instead. And when Lot's wife looked back, she became a pillar of salt. It wasn't a memorial for them, brethren. It's a memorial for us today. Remember Lot's wife. Remember Lot's wife. Going back to Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17 once again. Let's pick up the flow here. Even so, it will be in that day when the Son of Man is revealed. Verse 30. In verse 31, in that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come back to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. Don't come down to get your stuff. Don't go back to get your stuff. This is talking about the return of Jesus Christ. Would we even consider if Jesus Christ was coming to go back to get something? Or instead, is this talking about the previous two examples that are mentioned here? Before the flood, there were warnings. Before the destruction of Sodom, there were warnings. Some listened and some disregarded the warning message. Again, verse 32, remember Lot's wife. Verse 33, whoever seeks to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life will preserve it. I tell you, in the night there will be two men in the bed. One will be taken and the other will be left. Two women grinding together, the one will be taken and the other left. Verse 36, two men in the field, one will be taken and the other left. So some will heed and some will not. Some will leave and some will refuse. Remember Lot's wife. She became a pillar of salt when she was on her way to a safe haven, to a place of safety, if you will, because she didn't want to leave. In the next verse, verse 37, I find interesting. In verse 37, and he answered and said to him, where, Lord? Where? And he said to them, Wherever the body is, there are eagles that will be gathered together. What have we seen about eagles today? They live in the wilderness, and on eagles' wings, the church or the congregation of God was taken from one place to another, as we saw in Leviticus 19 and Deuteronomy chapter 32. It's an interesting response from the one who was the Lord of the Old Testament. Before the flood came, the warning went out. But only Noah and his family were in the safety of the ark. The others were destroyed. The warning went out about Sodom. They were to flee the city. But those who stayed behind, brethren, made a terrible mistake. A terrible mistake. Lot had to flee without his wife, and he lost her. But the prophecy seemed to imply that some will flee and some will not. Will the parable of the 10 virgins come into play here? I don't know. But the parables were placed in the Bible for us to read and to consider. The Bible doesn't say. Let's turn to the book of Daniel now. Daniel chapter 11. One of the most detailed prophecies is described in Daniel chapter 11. In verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. The king of the north will be the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. The king of the south will be an Arab conglomerate, perhaps even from Egypt. In an article entitled The King of the North, in a Life, Hope, and Truth article, it says, why will the king of the south attack the king of the north to initiate this conflict at the end of the age? Perhaps it will be over economic disagreements. Perhaps it will be over the treatment of Muslims in Europe. Perhaps it will be a religious dispute between the king of the north coming into the Middle East. Regardless of the reason or reasons why this king of the south and the king of the north fight, writes this article, prophecies in the book of Zechariah explain that Jerusalem would be the focal point of conflict before Jesus Christ returned. The passage tells us that the king of the north will likely be a revival of the Roman Empire, the fourth kingdom spoken in Daniel 2 and 7, as well as Revelation 17, and successfully counterattack the king of the south. Verses 41 and 43 indicate in the process he will enter the glorious land, or the holy land, if you will, and that he will gain control or have power over the treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt. And as for the identity of the south, the reign of the Ptolemaic rulers from Egypt came to an end long ago, yet it appears that Egypt, again, writes Mr. Trabig, will once again either be the king of the south or align with other nations representing this power that will exist at the time of the end before Christ return. Verse 43. But in the midst of this prophecy, we see three nations and peoples mentioned that shall escape the king of the north. Shall we escape them? Verse 41. He shall enter the glorious land, and many countries are going to be overthrown. But notice, these three shall escape from his hand: Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Why does God allow Edom and Moab and the prominent people of Ammon escape from the king of the north? These three Arab areas of wilderness, why do they escape? Does it have anything to do in common with the wilderness and what the church will flee? Well, sorry to leave you with a cliffhanger, but I am simply out of time. So I will try to pick this up next time. I felt this information was vital to understanding the prophecies. There are a lot of exciting prophecies that we'll go over next time, God willing. There are some astonishing detailed prophecies still yet ahead. So stay tuned for more end-time considerations coming soon to a theater near you.